It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
That seems to me like government is establishing a religion.
The latest in politics and world affairs.
If you give people rights, women's rights, gay rights, whatever, there can't be equal rights if there's special rights.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
Surveys show that people still really prefer freedom versus force.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation.
December 7th, 1941, 80 years ago today, was the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, that drew America into World War II. And I think it's very important that we talk a bit about that today. Welcome. This is Kim Munson. And I appreciate each and every one of you for joining us. You're each treasured, valued. You have purpose. Today, strive for excellence, take care of your heart, your soul, your mind and body, and live with intention. And Steve, it's hard to believe that it was just 80 years ago today that we were drawn into World War II.
Well, I was just thinking what it must have been like when this, you know, on December 8th, the shock, you know, it had been 15 months since Hitler invaded Poland. And everybody thought, well, you know, our focus, our concentration is on Europe. And all of a sudden, this thing cuts loose. And what it must have been like to think of a two-front war on the horizon.
My dad is one of six children from Western Kansas, and I'm one of 24 grandchildren. And my father is the second to the youngest, and had two older brothers that were the exact age to fight in World War II. And he said he remembers my grandfather listening to FDR's speech on one of those old radios. And he said he just remembers his father, my grandfather, just crying. And in fact, yes, both my uncles, my older brother, or my dad's older brothers, did serve in World War II. They were in the European theater. One was in the Communications Corps in the Army, and the other was a bombardier in the Air Force. And they both went in very young. My second to the oldest, my uncle, who was a bombardier, I think he was like 18 when he went in. He returned home at the age of 22 to farm. And I think he was a second lieutenant. And I talked to my cousins recently, and they never know what happened that he became a second lieutenant, because I think he went in just as a basic private, I think. And it's so important that we know these stories. That's why we do this America's Veterans Story Show. We want to talk a bit more about this. You have something to say, Steve?
Well, I just realized I caught myself here. For the sake of accuracy, it wasn't 15 months between those events. It was 27 months between those events. So just set the record straight here.
Yeah, we like to get it right. And during that time, of course, there was the Battle of Britain, and Hitler was attacking Britain, London, on a regular basis, and Churchill was reaching out to FDR on a regular basis to ask for help. And It was kind of wonky what was going on. And, of course, the supply lines between the United States and Britain, Germans with their submarines continued to attack boats on those supply lines. So, yeah, it was a bit of a surprise when the attack occurred. And this is via Wikipedia, but it says the attack on Pearl Harbor was a surprise military strike by the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service upon the United States against the naval base at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu just before 8 o'clock on Sunday, December 7th, 1941. I guess it was a beautiful day. And he said at the time, the United States was a neutral country, and it led to our formal entry into World War II. And it says Japan intended the attack as a preventive action to prevent the United States Pacific Fleet from interfering with Japan's planned military actions in Southeast Asia. They were the aggressor there. Important to understand. And it says it was against the overseas territories of the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, and the United States. Over the course of 7 hours, there were coordinated Japanese attacks on the U.S.-held Philippines, Guam, Wake Island, and the British Empire in Malaya, Singapore, and Hong Kong. And it says the base was attacked by 353 Imperial Japanese aircraft, including fighters, level and dive bombers, and torpedo bombers. And there were two waves, and they were launched from six aircraft carriers. Of the eight U.S. Navy battleships present, all were damaged, with four sunk, and all but the USS Arizona were later raised, and six were returned to service and went on to fight in the war. The Japanese also sank or damaged three cruisers, three destroyers, an anti-aircraft training ship, and one mine layer. A total of 188 U.S. aircraft were destroyed, 2,403 Americans were killed, and 1,178 others were wounded. And it says important base installations such as the power station, the dry dock, the shipyard, the maintenance, and the fuel and torpedo storage facilities, as well as the submarine piers and headquarters building, were not attacked. That is very remarkable, Steve. And the other thing is my understanding is our aircraft carriers were out to sea, and so they were not damaged either. So there certainly was... there were repairs that needed to be made, but it is really an act of God that they didn't hit the fuel storage facilities. They still had those submarine piers. The aircraft carriers were out to sea. But it was pretty devastating for sure, Steve.
Well, you took away my thunder, because I think it was Nimitz or who were the other big admirals, military officers there. But that assessment was made. The fact that the carriers were at sea, they didn't touch the fuel depot and the dry docks. So any repairs that were needed could be commenced immediately and right there on site.
Right. Instead of having to try to get back to the mainland, you can't imagine the amount of time on that. So it's pretty remarkable. And I wanted to just mention, though, my friends, why we're in the situation that we're in here in America. And I was going through, I think that I get whatever it is, MSN, I can't remember exactly which site I have, you know, when you go onto your computer, and I like to have it there because it kind of gives me an idea of, you know, what's going on with the news out there. But I just ran through it very, very quickly, and there was nothing at all about Pearl Harbor at all. And then some of the things here that's running through here is, police make gruesome discovery after frat fight, 43 holiday gifts that are selling like hotcakes in 2021. Blake just revealed the real reason Adam wasn't invited to his wedding with Gwen. Chris Norris says Kim Cattrall fallout with Sarah Jessica Parker was sad and uncomfortable. This is the kind of stuff that is the headlines when we have the 80th anniversary of America being attacked and drawn into World War II. So what do we do about that, Steve? I've thought about that. What do we do about that? Well, we do this show, and we need to support teachers that make sure that they're teaching our history. And we as parents, as grandparents, as aunts and uncles, we need to continue to mention this and teach this to our children and our grandchildren, Steve.
Well, as long as you and I have been working together, you know I've been banging my head against the wall, almost literally, asking that very question. How do you get people to come to a just a reasonable knowledge of our history when in the onslaught of all those superfluous things you just read off the MSN website? I mean, who cares? But yet somebody does. And they can't tell you what the significance of December 7th was or is.
Well, and that is why I continue to be more and more convinced that it's this grassroots, it's this swell of everyday people that are waking up. I can't tell you how many women's groups are out there. I was up at the Tapas and Topics in Windsor last night, and talking about just what is happening there. Of course, we also were talking in Fort Collins. That city council has moved so far to the left and putting in progressive, actually they're regressive policies, as one of my friends mentioned. It is regressive. It's not progressive, because throughout history, it's really been a king or a czar or a pharaoh or whatever who is the, you know, who governs everybody else. In America, the idea that we would be a people, that we would govern ourselves, was so radical. And so what we see happening now, going to, once again, it's not just one person right now, but it's this whole bureaucratic state, these elitists that are our king, our pharaoh, or whatever, and wanting to be lords over all of us. That's not progressive, Steve. It's regressive. But yet there's been this battle of language for many, many years. So it's important to understand that. So we need to reclaim our American idea. And being drawn into World War II, I wanted to share something that is just extremely remarkable that just happened. And my mother called me and said that the United States Navy had reached out to her, and she said, "You remember Dad's cousin, Wilbur Newton?" And we'd always heard his name as kids. And again, I wasn't totally paying attention on what all was going on, but he was at Pearl Harbor and he was killed there. And so just within the last week, the USS, or the United States Navy, has reached out to my mother. And they have actually identified his remains. And this is the background on it. It said, on December 7th, 1941, and this is from the United States Navy, the battleship USS Oklahoma was moored at berth F5, outboard of the USS Maryland at Ford Island, Pearl Harbor, when attacked by Japanese forces. The Oklahoma suffered multiple torpedo hits, causing it to capsize. 429 sailors and Marines were lost, including Seaman First Class Wilbur Francis Newton. In the days, months, and years following the attack, remains of the men lost aboard the Oklahoma were recovered, and ultimately 35 were identified. And the unidentified remains were buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. It's called the Punch Bowl, and they were known as the Unknowns. Permission to exhume the graves of the USS Oklahoma was given in 2015, and through these new forensic techniques, they were actually able to identify Wilbur's remains. And as it turns out, my father is Wilbur's oldest living relative, and so they need to notify him about this. And my father is not available until Thursday to be able to do this. But at that point in time, then they will try to determine a final resting place for Wilbur's remains. And I just find that remarkable that that has happened 80 years, just almost to the day of that attack. And the care and the respect that the United States Navy is giving to Wilbur, I think, is just amazing. And I just wanted to share that with all of you. And Wilbur was 29 years old when this all occurred, Steve.
It's incredibly commendable. And, you know, sometimes the interface between the government and the military is, it's not pretty. I'm impressed that they continue.
You mean like right now where they're, and with what's going on
well,
with the military?
Right now, but even when I was in the military, there was a lot of gnashing of teeth sometimes when you realize that your pay raise was tied up in some farming bill. But I am really impressed that these efforts are still going on 80 years later. That's just awesome.
Well, it is. And really, after all the work that I've done with America's Veterans Story Show and all that I've learned, this was just this name in my childhood that I didn't really understand. I didn't really know what happened. And here it's like he's come alive, and the fact that he existed, that they found his remains. And so I find it just really, really pretty amazing. And I think about all of you, like you, Steve, all our veterans, all our military that have put on the uniform to stand against tyranny and to stand for liberty. And I am so grateful to the American soldier, the Marine, the sailor, from the very beginning of our country to now. And just want to say thank you. And again, at some point in time today, my friends, stop and reflect about all that happened in World War II. And it all began for America today, 80 years ago. So we're going to go to break. Before we do that, though, Castlegate Knife and Tool is a great sponsor of both of my shows. Hal and Linnea Van Herke are the owners of Castlegate Knife and Tool, and they have knives and all kinds of gift items, but knives from the best blade makers from throughout the world. And they have just opened up a pop-up store over at the Castle Rock Mercantile as well. So it's a great place to do your holiday shopping, whether or not you are shopping for a chef or a sportsman or a collector. So be sure and check out their website. That is castlegate.com. Castlegate.com. And Steve, let's complete this particular segment. You had the quote from the Imperial Japanese commander Yamamoto. And what did he say?
Well, I need to maybe set this up a little bit. I heard a great commentary this morning, not on this station because we were not on the air, but
you got that up on the air. That's a good thing.
Yeah,
amazing.
It's a great commentary, though. And the speaker was talking about these nations that are position of weakness versus position of strength. And the point he was making is that Japan was not necessarily working from a position of strength. You know, their problem started in the 1920s, when they wanted to become an industrial, and more of an industrialized nation, but they, being an island nation, they didn't have the resources, the natural resources. So they were getting pretty uppity in their, you know, going to East Asian countries and taking whatever they wanted. Who was in their way? Who stood in their way? The United States Navy, therefore, you know, and I'm, you know, making this a very light-hearted approach to what actually went down. But Yamamoto, the naval admiral, I think maybe he got this position of strength thing versus position of weakness. And after it was all over later that day, the way the movies portray it, he was quoted as, "I fear all we have done is to awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." So I'm thinking maybe he really understood who had the position of strength here.
Well, did you know that Yamamoto actually spent time in the United States? And I think I'm doing this from memory now, but I think that he attended like our war college. And so he understood America. Did you know that?
Yes. The newest Midway movie, or the movie about Midway, starts out with that particular aspect. It's Yamamoto and one of the other intelligence officers who U.S. intelligence officers in the movie. They were, I mean, I won't say they were great friends, but they were acquaintances at this college, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so he understood a lot about America. One other thing, and I didn't really realize this till I started doing all of these America's veteran stories, but the very next day, Japan then attacked the Philippines. And then that began that whole Bataan Death March, which was so cruel. And many Americans lost their lives in that, as well as many Filipinos. And so they became just, they were planning this out. They were real aggressors. And I hadn't realized that attack was so quick after the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Well, yep, that's the way it went down. And again, what I just said about how audacious they were in the Pacific, and all those countries, East Asian countries, obviously China they went into, the Korean Peninsula, they were all over the place. They were very busy.
Yes, they were very busy. So anyway, 80 years ago today, make sure that you let your kids, your grandkids, young people in your life know about that so that they can at least start to ponder what happened 80 years ago today. So we're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue with some headlines. Third and fourth segment, we'll be talking with Josh Phillip with the Epoch Times about current events. So stay tuned.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And I do appreciate all of you who support us. We are an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to implement it. And it is never a good idea to take other people's rights, their property, their freedom, or their livelihood via force, whether it's with a weapon or a policy, unpredictable and excessive taxation, fear, coercion, or the latest silent thief, which is government-induced inflation. And do like to always mention I get to work with this great team, and that's Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, Charlie, all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting.
You know, when you say if something is a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people. That, you know what that says? It says that there must not be many good ideas out there these days.
Yeah, we're seeing force big time, and we'll talk about it in just a minute. I did not share our quote, and this was from Admiral Nimitz. He was the Fleet Admiral of the United States Navy, and he played a major role in the naval history of World War II as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet and Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Ocean Areas, commanding Allied air, land, and sea forces during World War II. He was born in Fredericksburg, Texas in 1885. He died in 1966. And this is a quote that I think is attributed to Iwo Jima, which was, you know, several years later. Because what they realized is that there were all these islands up and down in the Pacific. And our commanders were trying to figure out, they couldn't secure each island. The Japanese were on most all of these islands, so they had to determine which islands they were going to take. And Iwo Jima was within striking distance of our bombers of Japan. And so it was one of the latest battles, and it was an amphibious landing. And, of course, we've had some of these Iwo Jima veterans on the show, Jim Blaine, Don Whipple. But this is what Chester Nimitz said. He said, by their victory, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Marine Divisions and other units of the 5th Amphibious Corps have made an accounting of their country, which only history will be able to value fully. Among the Americans who served on Iwo Island, uncommon valor was a common virtue. And my friends, I do say it on a regular basis. We are Americans. We stand on the shoulders of giants. And now is our time. We are facing a crazy tyranny that's going on right now. This whole get the jab or lose your job, lose your livelihood. Again, that goes back to our quote. It's never compassionate to take other people's livelihood via force. And this get the jab or lose your job, it doesn't take into account. This narrative doesn't take into account the fact that there are therapeutics out there. There's treatments. And early treatments are very, very important. And then also people that have had COVID that have the antibodies, one has to ask, what's the science, Mr. Fauci or Dr. Fauci, Mr. You know, Dr. Science there? Why is there not any leeway for people that have the antibodies, which has got to be, I got to think, is more effective than the vaccine, and really it's still an experimental drug. But we're seeing such force on that. Get the jab, lose your job. Get the jab if you want to travel. Get the jab if you want to go to a concert. Get the jab. It's almost a more insidious kind of force, Steve.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, word pictures have always been effective on me. Can you visualize a tug of war? Two teams, on each end of the rope pulling, you know, and the goal is to get that flag that's in the middle to a certain boundary, and then you win. I envision this whole virus and the vaccine thing like a tug of war. You have these governments at all levels here, like we've been discussing on our pre-call, whether it's a local city, a state government, and as Germany has recently displayed for us, it can happen at a national level as well. And yet there's enough pushback being mounted that, you know, they're not having immediate success. As a matter of fact, it seems to be going the other way sometimes. Certainly President Brandon is seeing this, that all these different courts and judges are saying, hey, not so fast. And the lawsuits are popping up left and right. And I stand amazed.
Well, and people are starting, and I've been talking to people that have gotten the jab. And if you choose to do that, freedom, that's great. With get the information. If you decide to do that, that's fine. But look at this headline. This is from the Epoch Times. And it said the COVID-19 outbreak reported on U.S. cruise ship despite fully vaccinated passengers and staff. So I was talking to a young person yesterday who had gotten two of the jabs and said, it doesn't work. It's not really working. And you feel pretty crummy after you get the jab. And so I think we're seeing this really kind of ramping up of force to get the jab, because a lot of people are going, wait a minute, the narrative out there is not matching up. So just a couple of things here. New York City, de Blasio, comrade de Blasio has come out and said that they are now going to mandate COVID-19 vaccines for private sector workers. This is really beyond belief. And then also over in, let's see, Nevada said it's going to impose a surcharge on unvaccinated workers. So that is another, it's subtle but not so subtle, trying to push people to get a vaccination, taking away their choice. And again, there's no conversation about the therapeutics, the treatments, the early treatments on this, nor the fact that people would have the natural antibodies. It is absolutely astounding, Steve. I just can't believe it.
Well, the Clay Travis and Buck Sexton, the guys who took over for Rush Limbaugh, were talking about what's going on in New York City, and they were the mindset, this is de Blasio's last hurrah. I guess in January he will be out and the new mayor takes over. And I guess the new mayor, not that, you know, he's going to be, you know, they're set up for sainthood, but apparently he's already signaling that he's not going to be near as gung-ho on this stuff as de Blasio.
Well, and I tell you, I mean, I used to go to New York on a regular basis, and I have no interest. It's dangerous. You know, all of this force there, I just have no interest. And so he's killing New York. But we're seeing these blue cities across the spectrum. The crime is so high. In fact, there is a headline that down near Union Station here in Denver, it is one of the top three crime areas here in Denver. And here they took all of that economic development money to, you know, rebuild Union Station. And I have no interest in going down there anymore either. But we're going to go to break. Before we do that, both my shows are sponsored by Hooters Restaurants. They have five locations. That's Loveland, Westminster, Aurora, Lone Tree, and Colorado Springs. And they have all kinds of lunch specials. They have $8 specials, $9 specials, and $10 specials. Great place to get together with friends during the holidays. That is Hooters Restaurants. Check out my website for all of my sponsors. We're going to go to break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Josh Phillip.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Check out our website. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. And you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And on the line with me is Josh Philip, and you know him. He's a senior investigative reporter with the Epoch Times and the host of Crossroads and somewhat regular guest on the show. I always learn so much from him. Josh Philip, welcome to the show.
Hey, pleasure being back, Kim.
First question. I, for much of the time, had called it the Epic Times, but you call it the Epoch Times, and a number of my friends do. Can it be called both, or what is the proper pronunciation?
Well, you know, we confuse people because I think our own staff tends to use, like, epic, epoch, and epoch kind of interchangeably. Okay, technical American pronunciation is epic. If you're Canadian or British, it's epoch. That's the general how it goes. But, you know, really, it's, you know, you say epic, I say epoch. It's all good.
And we, yeah, that, okay, well, thank you for clarifying that. So we're all correct, I think, is what you're saying. First thing, Josh, you're located in New York, yes or no?
Yeah, so I work out of the New York office.
Okay. Well, what do you think about de Blasio? I mean, I cannot believe he's come out with this edict that unvaccinated workers now have to be vaccinated as well. And again, not taking into account any therapeutics, natural antibodies. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, he didn't have the guts to do it until he was leaving office. So, you know, it's like he's going out the door and he's like, you know, setting the building on fire as he's leaving is what he's doing. It's kind of how I see it. You know, de Blasio, of course, was a Sandinista apologist. He was with them. His real name isn't even de Blasio. You know, he's a communist, frankly, just put plain and simple. And I really don't know whether what he did is going to stand or not. Personally, I doubt that it will, especially if you start getting the unions pushing back. Especially as they're trying to get, you know, New York back on its feet. And if they do something like this, I mean, it's possible some people might just want to work remote or work in Jersey or might not want to do it. And, it's a really not smart move. And again, I think he only did it because he was basically heading out the door and did it while he was heading out the door.
What has been so interesting through this whole coronavirus, Wuhan, China virus, is it has really shown the hand of these radical activists. And I do find it somewhat remarkable that he would totally show that hand on his way out because, as you mentioned, New York is struggling, and this does not look like something that's going to help it at all. It's so interesting that the hand has been shown, and it's pretty scary to see what they're willing to do, Josh.
Well, doesn't surprise me with de Blasio. He hasn't done many things that are beneficial for New York. And, you know, I think that's kind of been his, like, modus operandi, you know, politics over well-being of the American people. And generally speaking, you know, and politics, by that I mean politics towards the communistic or socialistic worldview. I've been in New York since 2008. And I can tell you how much the city has changed since then. It's horrifying, actually. It's like, you know, you walk down the streets now. I mean, I go to work, of course, in Manhattan. I walk down the streets now, and there's people doing drugs in broad daylight. Police are standing by just watching them because they can't do anything about it. You don't feel safe. You have businesses, for example, in the banking sector, telling employees not to dress nicely. You have some businesses offering employees like car services after work because it's not safe anymore. You know, when I first arrived in New York, you could go anywhere in the city, anywhere within most of the, almost anywhere within the five boroughs, and you'd be mostly safe. You, at the very least, you didn't even really think about it because it wasn't something you would normally even have to think about. These days, it is not like that. New York is really going back to the 90s, it seems. And, yeah, that's de Blasio's doing because he was handed a pretty nice deal, and he just unraveled the whole thing.
From an election standpoint, do you think New Yorkers are waking up and understand that these elections really have consequences? It's not impossible to turn this around because Giuliani did do that. What's your feeling of New Yorkers?
My feeling of New Yorkers is that they don't see it as a political. This is my feeling generally. A lot of them are pretty far left, and a lot of them don't see the problems as being a problem of the left. They tend to see it as a problem of the individual. And I mean, and this is something you get with like communist and socialist apologists anyways, is they'll say, oh, that wasn't communism, that was Stalinism. Oh, that wasn't communism, that was Maoism. They'll always say, oh, it was the person who didn't do it well, they became a tyrant. They did things poorly. It's not the ideology, it's the person. And then they vote for another person of the same ideology, and they do it again. And it just keeps going in circles like that. Generally speaking, a lot of New Yorkers that I've seen are like that, unfortunately.
And yet we hear that New Yorkers are moving. Of course, taxes are high. Some very prominent people have moved out of New York because of such high taxes. And even they lean left politically. And what I found is human nature is people, those that may advocate for higher taxes, actually, they're advocating for higher taxes for you, not for them. In fact, Governor Polis out here in Colorado, it recently came to light that, and he's a very wealthy man, that for 3 years he paid no income tax. Now, I don't think he probably did anything illegally. However, from an ethical standpoint, if you have these politicians and bureaucrats and interested parties, I call them PBIs, that are advocating for higher taxes, and then they're not paying taxes. I mean, there's nothing that prevents them from writing a check to the state of Colorado or the U.S. government. Correct, Josh?
Well, and that's typically what you get. I mean, when you're dealing with, like, the very wealthy, there's a lot of ways you can avoid paying taxes. If you have a good accountant, you're probably not paying much in taxes. And, you know, I think Trump said that, too. He's like, yeah, you know, I give a lot to charity. I think a lot of them have the mentality that if they're going to pay taxes, they'd rather open up a foundation and try to store it away, or they'd open up something that actually does benefit people and they can choose where their money goes. Yeah, fair enough. But, yeah, then you get a lot of these people who are kind of dodging that system, who are the ones advocating for higher taxes, which really tears down the middle class. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I'd say the people at the top don't mind that because it means less competition. I think this is why you have big, you know, mega, you know, conglomerate corporations like Amazon and so on, pretty much running the whole show. And they're all for just policies that will destroy the middle class.
Well, right. And we saw this through the whole lockdowns, the determination of essential and non-essential businesses. The big guys were considered essential, and your everyday mom and pops were considered non-essential. And it was government picking winners and losers. So, Josh, let's jump over now to Omicron. What's your thoughts about this new variant of the coronavirus?
Well, you know, there were actually many variants previously that really didn't really make headlines, because you already had a decent amount of panic going on in society, and it didn't matter so much. Omicron emerges right basically when things look like they're clearing up, they're opening up. All the data shows that Omicron is not that serious. It creates like a less serious version even of COVID-19. The sources, you know, the medical sources in South Africa were saying it's not that big, it's not that bad, it's not a big deal. But then you have organizations, the World Health Organization and others, making it sound like we're going to face the next Ebola plague. And some of them even exactly used that phrase to characterize Omicron. Based on what? Nothing. based on nothing other than the idea that they say, oh, well, it's mutating in a lot of different ways. Fair enough. What the Omicron virus has done, though, is it's given these governments a reason to keep their emergency powers. It's given them a reason to expand emergency protocols. And it's given them a way to, I think, reignite the flames of fear that were dying out. You know, one thing I mentioned on my show that I think is really important to note, when you want to see where something is heading, look at the trajectory. And by that, I mean, look at the pattern of events and look at where that pattern is heading. Now, we can look back at when the virus first emerged to where we are now. We have not become more free. We have not gotten our rights back. As a matter of fact, in most parts of the world, it's gotten significantly worse. And the policies are getting worse and worse. In other words, the trajectory is it's going to be worse, not better, because it's progressively, and I think that's a good use of this term in this case, it is progressively leading to more and more and more government controls over our basic lives, not less. And there's no sign of this trend ending right now.
Well, that is what is really concerning to me. I can feel this oppression. And it's different from state to state. When I go up to Wyoming, it's a much freer state, and it just feels different. That's why the American idea of federalism, where we have all these different states and state sovereignty on those particular issues, where different states can make different decisions, and that has really driven the I think it's so interesting that you've drawn that correlation between this progression and progressives. And that's why they have really wanted to have like a nationwide lockdown. They don't want one state to actually have different data and how they've reacted to these different viruses, because if there hasn't been lockdowns and there's no difference between the infection rates, then it shows that Dr. Fauci, is not really basing all of this, quote unquote, on science. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, we've come to finally learn what they mean when they say trust the science. Because, you know, here I was thinking when they say trust the scientists, it meant like trust the scientific data, like, you know, looking at possible remedies to the virus, and trust the scientific data of people questioning the efficacy of face masks. But now we've gotten clarification that science is actually Fauci, because he has declared publicly now that he is science. And so, you know, the mystery has been solved, right? in terms of policy, though, you're absolutely right. When you have different policies enacted in different areas, you start to see which ones work and which ones don't. Now, what's the state now with some of the lowest infection and death rates? It's Florida. And Florida also has some of the, you know, the loosest standards in terms of dealing with the virus. And I think that's actually very telling.
Well, it is very telling. And we're going to go to break on this. When we come back, I'd like to talk about the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. I was looking at your podcast, and you've been addressing that as well. But how would you like to button up this whole thing regarding de Blasio, force, this trajectory, Omicron? Because you always somehow get nuggets of hope out of these things that seem so concerning. So what's your final thought on this in this segment, Josh?
The final thought is that Democrats are overplaying their hand. And in a way that's, I think, going to make them really, really lose out in the polls come 2022. And you can watch the federal government right now trying to even block some of the redistricting Republicans are doing. It's because they know that they're going to lose. In fact, all their own analysts, a lot of them, are telling them they're going to lose. And so what do they do in response to the, you know, data showing they're going to lose hard in 2022? They increase the things that are making them lose potentially hard in 2022. And so you're watching them overplay their hand. You're watching them get overconfident. And you're watching them really destroy their reputations, even among a lot of their hardline voters. And that's how I see it personally.
Okay. Yeah, it's pretty interesting to watch this hand being played, and the redistricting thing. All these little things are super important. I'm talking with Josh Philip, and he is a senior investigative reporter with the Epoch Times and also the host of Crossroads. Before we go to break, though, the show's brought to you by great sponsors, and another one of them is Kirsch Insurance Group. December 7th, this is the last day for this open enrollment period for your Medicare choices for 2022. And Kirsch Insurance Group, they're specialists in the Medicare arena, and they can really help you navigate through that because they work with many different carriers to get the best plan for you. And so be sure and check them out. That's iKirsch, iKirsch.com. That's iKirsch.com. We're going to go to break. When we return, we'll continue the conversation with Josh Philip.
Life is more than what we have in the bank. Mary Alpers and Steve Kruse with Three Points Financial understand that comprehensive financial planning is an important component for each individual to thrive and prosper. Three Points Financial provides tax, investment, and retirement planning so that you can achieve your financial independence. With so much public policy uncertainty, it is important to have the professionals at Three Points Financial working for you to navigate those uncharted waters. Check out ThreePointsFinancial.com to schedule your initial consultation to achieve your financial freedom. That's ThreePointsFinancial.com.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. I am Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to all of you who support us. On the line with me is Josh Philip. He is the senior investigative reporter with the Epoch Times, the host of Crossroads, and I always learn so much when he's on the show. Josh Philip, before we get over to this, my questions about Ghislaine Maxwell. 80 years ago today, Pearl Harbor was attacked by Japan, and we talked about that in the first segment. What's your reflection on Pearl Harbor these 80 years later?
Well, you know, Pearl Harbor actually is pretty close to my family. So my great-grandfather was there, as were many of my great-uncles. I think I mentioned before, so I'm mixed race. My mom is white, my dad's mixed Hawaiian and Filipino. And so, of course, I had a lot of family in Hawaii. My dad and sisters lived, grew up there. But my great-grandfather, he was a chief steward. And basically it means he was like an officer cook. And he was the chief steward of Admiral King, who led all the Navy operations in World War II. Filipinos were not allowed to have combat roles, and so they were only allowed to be cooks and chiefs. Basically, they created this new officer cook role, and he was one of the first two. And on that note, too, my grandfather never made a big deal about my great grandfather never made a big deal about racism or anything like that. It wasn't something he cared about. He was proud of what he did. He loved this country. He loved the Navy. He loved everything he did. When the Japanese attacked, basically, he was running up and down the dock looking for his brother, and they didn't know what was happening. And he was actually in the first ship that broke through the blockade as well. I mean, he was just one of the guys on it. And, of course, I had a lot of other family who were in the Pacific as well, fighting, Marines and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's a very symbolic day because it was the day that America woke up. And I think it's actually something very telling about the nature of Americans. We tend to kind of not like to get involved in stuff unless we really have to. I think maybe, okay, fair enough, maybe under Bush that changed a bit. But I'd say with great criticism, of course. Americans tend to not like to get involved in things unless they have to. But once you get them involved, once they start uniting and once they wake up, they're really just an unstoppable force. I think that is the character of Americans. And on that note, too, I think this patriotism in America, and I think a huge phenomenon we were watching spread across this country and really the renewal of what this country is still there But we just don't see it because social media censorship and media censorship has basically silenced people and prevented us from seeing what everyone else is doing. I do believe that as soon as Americans are able to communicate openly again, and I do think that's going to happen when Trump releases his social media, which he's announced now as $1 billion in investment or planned investment, I do believe that we're going to see a real awakening in this country.
Well, and the work, Josh, that you and your colleagues are doing at the Epoch Times is a trusted source. And I can't tell you the number of women's groups, liberty groups, that are meeting in Colorado on a grassroots level is remarkable. I started a women's group in 2012 with 12 women. And we now, and just in my living room, and we now have that group. We have a group of Boulder, Fort Collins, a new group probably starting in Adams County, South Jeffco. And these women are just everyday Americans. And when you mention the word patriotic, the left has tried to make patriotic sound like it's something that's prideful. And it's pride, but not in a bad way. It's a friend of mine who is a patriotic historian said it's love of country. And I think we're seeing an awakening on that. And Josh Philip, I did not realize that you had such a connection with Pearl Harbor. That's remarkable as well. We've got about 5 minutes left. And as I was going through all of your different podcasts there, we're not seeing anything really regarding this Ghislaine Maxwell, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Epstein's girlfriend, but you've addressed that. And so what do you think people should know about that right now?
Well, a couple points. Ghislaine Maxwell was the associate of Jeffrey Epstein, who had the Lolita Express in Little St. John's Island, which was running essentially a pedophile prostitution ring for the world's elite. It does appear that the main witness who could potentially incriminate, for example, Prince Andrew and several others, is not going to be testifying, which does raise some questions in terms of, well, how far is this case going to go? I think a lot of people were anticipating that we'd see all this stuff opened up. The judge, in addition to all of this, has made it so that a lot of the really disturbing information will not be made public, saying that it's basically... I think that the word they used was impure. And I mean, look, you're dealing with trials and criminal trials. You have people getting murdered and going on trial, and they'll show you grisly images. Why is this considered impure? And we're somehow too innocent to know what Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were allegedly doing. At the same time, though, the case is opening the books on, well, this pedophile ring that was servicing the world elite, including world leaders, royalty, and top business leaders, and even top academics. And it, even if it doesn't mean incriminating many of these people, it does, I think, mean show the types of activities that were taking place. And it does, I think, also give a bit more fire, I'd say, underneath the individuals who were named in Jeffrey Epstein's public documents, where he did list his clients and the people who are traveling with him.
And I mean, I don't really know that list. I know Prince Andrew. There's been talk of Clinton. What are some of them, those names that people might recognize?
Oh, well, geez. Prince Andrew, Clinton. I mean, you can read Jeffrey Epstein's book. They had tons of them. When Jeffrey Epstein was arrested previously, he was actually charged and found guilty, but it was a slap on the wrist charge. Basically, they got him on one count of, I believe, soliciting sex from a minor, 16-year-old, I believe it was. He got a slap on the wrist charge. It was really nothing. And the real concerning part last time he was charged was that the FBI documents, and you could still read them online, said that he had video recordings of the rooms at Little St. John's where these activities were taking place. They had logs of the guests, and they had videos of the rooms. Why was the public never shown any of this? Why were we never told about any of this? And I think more importantly, if there was video evidence, why were these people not charged? I think this is important to ask. Quick note, everyone's saying Trump was there. Oh, they named Trump. The context of that is important. And I'm not trying to defend Trump on this just verbatim, but I think it is important to know because the media is talking about it so much. Trump did not fly on the Lolita Express. He flew with Epstein, I believe, from Florida to like New York or something like that, because there's some story behind it. He did not like Epstein. In fact, after Epstein allegedly tried recruiting one of the girls from, I believe, Mar-a-Lago, Trump actually banned him from Mar-a-Lago. So as soon as Trump figured out what Epstein was doing, he banned him. And so the context of that, I think, is important also.
Well, thank you for clarifying that, Josh. And I have a friend that has founded Voices Against Trafficking, and she said that the Trump administration did so much to fight human trafficking, and he never really got credit for that. Joshua Phillip, we have a minute left. How would you like to button up all that we've talked about today?
Well, you know, I would say again and again, if you look at the world right now, it looks like there's not a lot of hope. It looks like things are pretty chaotic, and they are pretty chaotic. But I would say also that if you look at history, typically when things get really bad, they tend to turn to the opposite extreme in a very dramatic way, typically. That when things are pushed to an extreme, often it flips to the other side. And if you look at, I think, why that is, because I've been trying to figure out why it is, looking at kind of the story of history, I think it's because when people see how bad something is, they all want to step forward and change it. And I think America right now, and a lot of the world right now, is kind of at that stage. I think that while it is pretty intense right now and people are dealing with a lot, it's also showing us the nature of a lot of the media organizations, the social media organizations, the business leaders, and many of the politicians who don't have a problem stripping away our rights, who don't have a problem enacting really intense forms of tyranny when they believe they have the power to do so.
And it is amazing that the people are stepping forward on this. Josh Phillip, it's always great to have you on the show. Thank you. And before
appreciate
we go to break,
thank
or, you. Yeah. And I guess not to break into the show, Chester Nimitz is our quote for the day. He said, "We shall never forget that it was our submarines that held the lines against the enemy while our fleets replaced losses and repaired wounds." So my friends, today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America.